Welcome to this special presentation from the 2020 Camden Conference held in February of 2020 in Camden, Maine. I'm Jim Campbell. The theme of this year's Camden Conference was The Media Revolution, Changing the World. This is the second in a series of programs on WERU from the Camden Conference. Today's program features Joshua Tucker, who, among other things, is a professor of politics and a co-director of the Social Media and Political Participation Laboratory at New York University. One of his research interests is in how effective people are at differentiating what are real news stories and what are, as he puts it, garbage stories that are made up and have little, if anything, to do with reality. Given this interest, it's not surprising that the title of his talk was Social Media, Democracy, Fake News, and Fact-Checking. In his presentation, he refers often to research that he and others have done on testing 150 different stories, some from reputable news organizations, some, quote, fake news, from sites that are set up to look like news sites, but most certainly are not. The research used the determinations of six professional fact-checkers about which stories were which, and then presented those stories to a reasonably representative sample of online news users to see whether those users were able to sort the real news stories from the fake ones. During his talk, he used on-screen slides, but always verbally referred to what was on the screen. After his talk, there was a question and answer session involving several speakers, which we'll hear part of later in the program. David Brancaccio, host of American Public Media's Marketplace Morning Report, was the conference moderator and, incidentally, grew up in Waterville, Maine. In his introductory remarks to the session in which Joshua Tucker spoke, Brancaccio responded to a question that people back in California, where he's based now, posed to him about why it wouldn't be better to go to Maine in March rather than February, which is the dead of winter. First, we'll hear his response to that question, which many listeners may want to remember and pass on, and then we'll hear his introduction of Joshua Tucker.
You know, some of you are saying, why are they doing this conference in February? My gosh, look at it. Well, first of all, it's beautiful, crisp, and clear, is one good reason. But why don't you do it a little later? Those of you from around here, a little later, you get into March, where the calendar is 56 days long. You know what it's like here in March. And so one time I was back here in March, and I was trying to get into my dad's house in Waterville, and luckily I had my boots on. Yeah, and getting up to the front of the house, and sure enough, lying there in the mud was a bowler hat. And I thought, that's weird. So I got myself a stick and I poked at it. I flipped it over. And son of a gun, there was Douglas Bates from Phippsburg, Maine, up to his neck in the mud. So I looked down at Doug, my old friend Doug, and I said, Doug, mighty muddy walking, isn't it? And he looked up at me and he said, David, this ain't the worst of it. The worst of it is I'm on horseback. Which is why, yeah, you know what it's like. Anyway, New York University's Joshua Tucker is professor of politics, co-director of the Center for Social Media and Politics, and director of the Jordan Center for the Advanced Study of Russia. His research interests clearly are broad. You can read more about them in the program. Today, he'll explore the crucial interplay among social media, democracy, fake news, and fact-checking. Dr. Tucker.
Thank you, David, for the very kind introduction. Thanks to all of you for being here today. It's a great honor to be invited. As David said, I'm going to be talking to you about social media and democracy, fake news, and crowdsourcing fact-checking. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to sort of start off and end up with some sort of larger points in thinking about social media and democracy and how we can study social media and democracy. And then I'm going to wrap that around showing you some research from our lab at the Center for Social Media and Politics, focusing on these topics of fake news and fact-checking. So what I want to begin with is a sort of broad-based way of thinking about how social media interacts with democracy, and in particular to ask this question. We started off way, way back, long time ago, right, all the way back in 2011, and social media got this coined by this name, this article appeared in the Journal of Democracy that was called Liberation Technology. And then a great deal of time goes by, many, many years, right, all the way up to 2017, 6 years later, and we get to, in the exact same Journal of Democracy, can democracy survive the internet? So the question is, how does social media, even for fast-moving technology, this is whiplash speed, how do we go from thinking about social media as something that's going to usher democracy in throughout the world, right? It's going to be this major challenge to authoritarian regimes, this major force for democratization, to is social media going to undermine democracy itself within 6 years? Did we get it really, really wrong way back in 2012, 2011, when we talked about liberation technology? Or are we overreacting now when we say, can democracy survive the internet? I wrote a piece along with a number of co-authors that also appeared in this Journal of Democracy that's called From Liberation to Turmoil. And in this, what we try to do is explain how social media can be both liberation technology and can democracy survive the internet. And the way we do it is by making two simple assumptions. So the first assumption is that social media is a tool that provides voice to people who are excluded from access to mainstream media. So that's the first assumption. Voice to people who don't have access to mainstream media. The second assumption we make is, despite the fact that social media democratizes access to information, and I would stand here today and say that that is an indisputable claim, social media has given more access to more people about more things and more information about politics, about news. So it's democratized access to information. But despite the fact that it democratizes access to information, it's still a tool that can be used for censorship. So let me walk you through how these arguments can explain how social media is both liberation technology and can democracy survive the internet. We start with a new hope: social media as liberation technology. The context here is in authoritarian regimes. If we think about authoritarian regimes, or what political scientists often call competitive authoritarian regimes, and we ask the question, outside of open societies, who is excluded from access to mainstream media? Well, it may be other potential authoritarian actors, but maybe it's nationalists in these countries, maybe it's other people who want to have power. But almost by definition, when you're in an authoritarian regime, you're going to exclude pro-democracy forces, people who want to bring about regime change. You're going to exclude them from access to mainstream media. These are not the people who are going to be showing up on the evening news and in the pages of the newspapers. So in the context of authoritarian regimes, social media becomes a tool that can be used by pro-democracy forces because it allows them to communicate. It allows access to information. As the way we talk about it as social scientists, it can be a tool that's helpful in overcoming collective action problems. It allows people to get organized. It's a vertical communication tool. And it's a way, in particular, when these social media platforms are located in the West and they're outside the control of governments within these countries, it's a way that pro-democracy actors are able to communicate with each other. And that's when we get things like the Arab Spring, or Euromaidan in Ukraine, or Gezi Park in Turkey. And so we have this kind of a new hope liberation technology. This picture in particular, the Who's Afraid of Twitter, is a famous photo that came out of the Gezi Park protests in Turkey. So there's your kind of liberation technology. But of course, nothing really ever happens in a vacuum in politics. And what we end up with, of course, when certain actors act in one way, other actors will eventually react. Now, it may be the case that there was a period of time where authoritarian regimes were not understanding of the threat posed by democracy. There are reasons we think that authoritarian regimes may have difficulties understanding new threats, especially if the way the power structure is set up is that you get closer to higher levels of power by being a yes person to the great leader or whoever that happens to be. You don't want to be the one in the room necessarily saying there's this huge new problem out there that we don't see coming. So maybe there was a period of time where regimes were not aware of this. But of course, over time, regimes begin to see that this is a threat. And what happens then is that regimes have to think about how they're going to respond to online opposition. And I would posit, and we've written a piece along with other co-authors from the social media, from the SMAP Lab, we've written a piece in a journal called Comparative Politics, where we laid out a sort of big picture theoretical framework for thinking about the tools that actors had at their disposal, that these authoritarian regimes have at their disposal to respond to online threats. And you can basically think of these as one of three categories. The first is they can respond offline, right? You don't have to respond to an online threat online. You can respond to an online threat offline. That can be things that we would traditionally think about this, such as suppressing dissidents, locking up bloggers, even shooting people, physically harm, threatening the people who are involved in this. It can also involve not just these kind of attacks, particularly at the people that are mounting the online opposition, but it can also involve changing the legal structure, changing requirements for liability, changing these kinds of infrastructure where it's possible to go after online actors in different ways than was possible before, all the way up to the extent of trying to change the ownership of these companies. So if you study Russia, for example, you're familiar with VKontakte, which is a Russian social media outfit. And eventually, the founder of VKontakte had to flee the country and was replaced by a Putin loyalist. So that's one set of options that you have. You can always respond to online opposition offline. But a second set of options you have, and a third set, involve online responses. So the second thing we talk about is online restriction of access to content. This is kind of your traditional censorship. You try to prevent people from seeing the information online that's harmful to your regime. So if you have pro-democracy activists, you try to censor them. Now, the sort of regime par excellence about this is China, who I know you all talked about last year at the Camden Conference, and the sort of Great Firewall of China. This is the kind of understanding that we have of ways to deal with restricting online access to content. And there are other countries that engage in this kind of behavior as well. In a sense, though, this is an old story repackaged in a new technology. We have years of regimes that try to censor access to information, whether it's by censoring it in print media, censoring it in radio, censoring it in other forms. This can then just be brought to the internet. But it's difficult, and there are lots of different, there's trade-offs between different tools that you can do this, right? You can do this in a very clunky way, where you shut off access to the entire internet, which we've seen, for example, recently in Iran. But that causes all sorts of other collateral damage to your economy. It also ends up making people really angry when you're shutting down things that they want access to. Molly Roberts, who's one of my co-authors on the Liberation and Technology paper, has this fantastic paper where she actually looks at what happened when China restricted access to Instagram. You saw a huge jump in the number of VPNs that were being downloaded in China, at which point people started going and visiting the New York Times website and Google as well. So there's unintended consequences that happen from these sorts of things. But, and perhaps most germane for this discussion, there's a third way that regimes can respond, which is by what we call online engagement, which is trying to change the nature of the online conversation in a more beneficial pro-regime point of conversation. And in some ways, this is a good thing. Right? This harkens back to the original promise of e-government. Right? The internet was going to bring politicians and bureaucrats closer to the mass public. And so if what you have happening is politicians going online, getting involved in the longer version of this talk, I have a picture of Dmitry Medvedev out in Twitter, you know, putting his first tweet out into the public. In some ways, we think that would be a very positive thing. It breaks down barriers between politicians and the ruled and the masses. But of course, there are all sorts of other, more nefarious ways you can try to get involved with changing the nature of the conversation online. And that's where we get the rise of, we get bots. Those of you who are familiar with Soviet icons, you'll recognize the Putin, as this is a takeoff on the famous Brezhnev, you know, sending the tanks out. Now it's Putin sending out the Twitter birds. But you get the rise of bots, these kind of automated accounts that produce content. You can get trolls. You can get propaganda campaigns. You can get the rise of misinformation campaigns. And this is famously, this is the headquarters of the Internet Research Agency in Russia, which unleashed famously the Russian trolls on the 2016 election. So this is kind of the next stage, right? The empire strikes back, you get repression technology. Then we take the context, however, to what does this say about democracies, right? And this is the third piece of it, which is that in the context of democracies, if you ask who's excluded from access to mainstream media and democracies, well, you could take a kind of Chomsky Marxist viewpoint of this, that they're part of the capitalist means of production, and so more progressive voices are going to be excluded from access to mainstream media. And we do see, for example, the rise of things like Black Lives Matter or Occupy Wall Street facilitated by social media. But of course, in democracies, You also have, in general, and until perhaps very recently, you have these kind of anti-systemic, fundamentally, voices that are illiberal, that are against the sort of democratic system of politics. These are also excluded from access to mainstream media. You didn't turn on the TV and see white supremacists on the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite. So the same tools that can help pro-democracy activists overcome collective action problems, these tools can help people like white supremacists or non-democratic actors in democratic systems. They can also use these tools to find each other. If you're the only white supremacist in your entire county, previously when you were limited by geographic proximity to people to organize, it's a lot harder to get organized. Whereas now, if you can go on 8chan or 4chan and find other white supremacists, you can get organized in that format. The key thing here is it's the same affordances of social media that help the democracy activists in liberation technology that help people who may want to undermine democracy in this kind of rise of the anti-systemic forces. But this, again, is not operating in a vacuum. And what you have going on at this point in time now, of course, is that the tools that came out of these authoritarian regimes, bots, trolls, disinformation campaigns, these are tools that can be used by these anti-systemic actors in democracies as well. And in particular, they can be used for amplification, for making voices louder. Right? So think about this for a second. How many of you in this room have heard of the Women's March, and how many of you have heard of the march in Charlottesville? People have heard of these things. How much media attention have you heard to each of these things? The Charlottesville March had 300, 400 people in it. The Women's March had 4.5 million people, and it was the largest march in the history of the United States ever. And yet, with these amplification tools, we can get these senses of equivalency. So the big picture thing here is that when we think about social media, this question of from liberation to technology, the argument we make is that social media itself is neither inherently good nor bad for democracy. Social media, and the way to think about it is, it's a set of tools with a set of affordances that political actors who interact with each other and take account of what the other political actors are doing will try to use to compete for power, the same way that political actors always use tools that they have at their disposal. And so if we want to understand the politics of this moment correctly, what we need to do is understand the affordances of these tools. I've shared some of them with you here today. What I want to do now is dive deeper into some of the sort of research that we've been doing in terms of these questions. Now, I will say it is very, very rare experience, and I'm a bit flattered to be the third speaker on a program and have had everyone mention one of your main findings that you presented in your talk before you even get to present it in your talk. So I'm going to walk you through. I'm going to walk you through what we did here. So as you know, 2016, if you were watching the 2016 election in the United States, it would be pretty impossible to have heard a discussion of that in the aftermath without this discussion of fake news. Now, I share Nico and some of the points that have been raised before about using this term, fake news. In this particular study, we're actually going to use this to refer to sort of fake newspapers, things that were pretending to be real newspapers that were not newspapers. But you would have seen all sorts of things like this had you been paying attention, that the Pope had endorsed Donald Trump, or that Hillary Clinton, it had been confirmed that she did in fact sell weapons to ISIS and other things along these lines. You will also have seen things, and I thank Nick for having shown way more detail on this, so I can go through this slide quickly, but about how people are consuming much more news from online sources, how that's particularly true among the young, but is increasing among all aspects of the population. So the question remained, though, after the election, we got a lot of information about fake news. And when I think about fake news or misinformation or disinformation, right, these deliberate attempts to spread incorrect information, I always think there are four big questions we want to understand. One is who produced this. The second is who shared it. The third is who's exposed to it. And the fourth is what's the impact of being exposed to it. In the aftermath of 2016, there was very good work done by journalists in particular on that first question, who was producing this fake news? We got these reports about Macedonian teenagers and profit motives and stuff like that. Although, of course, now 3 years later, we're getting revisionist questions about who was actually paying the Macedonian teenagers, so that will continue to be a question for a while. What we realized in our lab is that in the aftermath of the election, We actually had the ability to go back and look at who had shared fake news on Facebook, which was not anything that we were getting any information about. And as the previous speakers have noted, what was being talked about is there are all these millennials who get all their news online, there's all this fake news, ergo it must be the millennials' fault that all this fake news is all over the place. But we realized we could figure this out. And how could we figure this out? Well, what we were able to do was we had a panel survey that was in the field over the course of the 2016 elections. That means we were surveying people at multiple points in time. We had invited people in that survey to share their Facebook data with us for the purpose of academic research. I'll come back to this at the very end of the talk, but I want to be assured we did not sell that data to any political consultants. We didn't do anything with that data. We got multiple permissions from people to use this data. But what we realized was that we had objectively the data people had actually post on Facebook on their timelines. And we also had surveys of these people. So we were working with YouGov. We had surveys of the people, and these people had shared their Facebook data with us. So we knew some of the problems with working with Facebook data is you don't often know the characteristics of the people on of working with social media data. You may not know the demographic characteristics of the people who are posting these things, and you have to do a lot of estimation to try to figure this out. When you work with survey data and you ask people, you have to recall to their recall, did you see this fake news story or not? Did you share this? And so we actually had both of these things. We had their demographic characteristics from the survey, and we knew what they had posted on Facebook because they had shared it with us. So we were able to go in and look at this relationships. This is the first graph I want to tell you. And one of the, I don't know how many of the other speakers are going to be showing figures today, but one of the things this follows very much after kind of what Nick just did before. When you get into data about online media consumption, about social media, you are going to see these kinds of distributions, which are called power laws, an awful lot. Which means a lot of the behaviors we talk about, and in particular a lot of the nefarious behaviors about which we're concerned, these are behaviors in which lots and lots of people have no engagement in it, and small numbers of people have a lot of engagement in it. And this has very strong consequences for how we think about policy interventions, which we can talk more about in the Q&A and may talk about at the end here. What we found, and the first thing is, which is quite encouraging, is that we found the vast majority of people didn't share any fake news stories on Facebook over the course of the election. In fact, this is over 90% of the people in our sample were in this far column. What we did find was there were small numbers of people who did this quite a lot. But we started with, so 91% of our sample doesn't share any fake news on Facebook. Now, we used a restrictive definition of Facebook. We were as of fake news. We were as conservative as we could. We took the list that was put out on BuzzFeed by Craig Silverman. We replicated our key findings with lots of other sources here. So, you know, this may be a conservative number. These are the fakiest of the fake news kind of websites. But again, we found this power law of behavior. The second thing we found was that it was not liberals or moderates who were sharing the fake news. But before anyone, I would go too far with this, this is very much an issue that can be considered as a supply-side issue. To the extent that, based on all academic studies, the vast, vast majority of the studies that we have seen have shown, all the academic studies we've seen, the vast majority of fake news in the 2016 US election had a pro-Trump slant to it. There was not an awful lot of pro-Clinton fake news that was out there. So this may very much be, and I'm going to show you in a second something that coincides with this, driven by supply in terms of the fake news that was out there was more pleasing to conservatives than it was to liberals. But it is important to know this, that when we look at who was doing the sharing of fake news in our study, this is what we found. It's also important because for the next slide I'm going to show you, we can also find the effect controlling for this. This is usually the kicker point of the talk. At this point, you've heard it three times already. But now you've seen the original, right? Not just the second. So you know, you got to do the greatest hits. So basically, this was the big surprise that we got when we were doing this study. What we found was that over 65s, on average, in our study, shared 7 times as many links to the fake news websites as the millennials did. We also found what academics call this is a monotonically increasing relationship. As you got older, you were on average more likely to have shared the fake news. Now, to be clear, this chart does not necessarily mean that most of the fake news that's out there is being shared by old people, because there are fewer over 65s who are online than people who are younger. But It does mean, as David said in the introduction, it does mean that if you walk out of 2016 and you think about policy interventions, and they're all focused on teaching digital literacy to high school students, and by the way, there's nothing wrong with teaching digital literacy to high school students. I'm hugely in favor of that. But this is not necessarily where you need to be teaching digital literacy if you think digital literacy is what's at the heart of that. And that then raises a whole set of really interesting research questions, which is, why is it age? Right, the Occam's razor explanation here is that it's digital literacy. People my age tell their parents to go on Facebook to see pictures of their grandchildren. They go on Facebook, they see something, especially in the 2016 election, there's a picture, a headline, and a blurb from the New York Times, and then next to it is a picture, a headline, and a blurb from the Denver Guardian, which looks exactly the same, saying that the Pope has endorsed Donald Trump, or saying something horrible about Pizzagate, and that they feel really bad about this, and they want to make sure their friends know about this. But of course, the Denver Guardian doesn't exist. It's not actually a newspaper, right? It's just been made up. That's the Occam's razor explanation. And I think this is the next frontier of research. We have to figure this out, because if you want to understand what's going on in this disinformation sphere, one of the most important things is knowing whether people are going to be less likely to share fake news if they know that it's false. Now, it may also be the case that people are sharing this information not because they think it's true, but because it agrees with their political persuasions. And if that's the case, then to get the results we do, you need an explanation about why people over 65 might be more interested in sharing their political persuasions and broadcasting them broadly to their friends and family network. We could come up with some explanations for why that might be the case. Some might be economic. You're out of the job market. You're not worried about what other people are going to think. Some might be just increased certainty in the validity of your political views as you get older. We know from decades of study of political partisanship, partisanship is stronger among older citizens than it is among younger citizens. So there's a lot of remaining questions out here, and this is kind of the frontier of this next research. All right, so the next thing I want to tell you about is a brand new study we're doing at the Center for Social Media and Politics on trying to figure out who can actually identify whether or not news is fake. So it follows from this. Or better yet, this is more going back to Nico's category of the junk news. So we're going to combine in this study false and misleading categories. And so this is the big research project that we're invested in. Everything I'm going to show you here is kind of preliminary, still rolling right off the presses. This is hot off the presses research, but I wanted to share it with you today. All right, so how were we able, what are we doing here? In this study, what we've done, which is quite unlike any other study that's been done in terms of identifying false or misleading news before, is we set up a system where we are looking at articles that appear in the first 24 hours of their publication. And what we did was we set up five different news streams, two from mainstream news sources, one with articles on the left, one with more mainstream news sources on the right, and then three from these kind of junk or suspect or false news or whatever you want to call them news sources, one a stream of left-leaning junk news, one a stream of right-leaning false news, and one a stream of, we couldn't even tell when we went and looked at it, it was all over the place, and some of this stuff was just nuts. So we have those five streams every day, and they come into our lab. And then what we did, and we did this 4 days a week, Monday through Thursday, for 8 weeks, we picked an article that had appeared in the last 24 hours, and we then did two things with it. One, we sent it out to a random sample of Americans where each story was coded by 90 different Americans, and at the same time, we hired six professional fact checkers to code every single one of these stories as well. So we're going to use, for the basis of this study, the fact checkers, what the modal response from the fact checkers are, and I'm happy to talk more about this in Q&A. What the modal response from the fact checkers is our ground truth. And we can now look at how our ordinary Americans are doing in identifying false and misleading news. So the first takeaway is, people aren't really good at this. They're pretty good at identifying true news. When the story itself was ranked true by our fact checkers, about 70% of our individuals can figure this out. When it's ranked false or misleading by our fact checkers, only 30% of our respondents are able to correctly identify that. Moreover, the source matters. People are much worse at the false and misleading news from the fake news sources than they are at getting the true news from the fake sources than they are at getting the true news from the mainstream sources. So they're even worse at identifying true news when it comes from these junk sources, which we can think of as good or bad. Interestingly, following on the previous study, age doesn't really seem to matter. Education doesn't really matter nearly as much as we thought. It would, although people with only a high school education perform worse on the task, but it's not a strong relationship. Knowing things about politics and the internet kind of help. People who are more politically knowledgeable are more likely to match our fact checkers, and people who are more digitally literate are more likely to match our fact checkers. But what really, really matters is partisanship. Conservatives are terrible at identifying false news that's conservative, and liberals are equally bad at identifying false news that has a liberal slant to it. So this is a major takeaway and a major point of concern here. If you go out and encourage people to actually search for information on the internet, I know it's only February, I don't want to dash this for you yet. So I'll give you the good news first. People who go out and search on the internet, we ran some experiments alongside of this, and in one of them we encouraged people to go search for information, did slightly better at identifying true news. So people who went out there were slightly more likely to match our fact checkers when it was true. Unfortunately, they also were slightly more likely to think false news was true when they went out and looked on the internet for information about it. So this confirms what social psychologists have called a truth bias, that people are inclined to think things are true as opposed to false. So this is also very kind of depressing information. Why do we care? Well, first thing, believing false news makes you more likely to want to share an article, right? We asked people, would you share this online? If people thought the story was true, 60% of them were willing to share it. If they thought it was false, it's closer to 20%, which is also kind of depressing if you think about it, that 20% of our sample was willing to share things they had just said were false. But more importantly, this is also important because the platforms are thinking about crowdsourcing. Facebook came out with this about a month ago. Twitter, there was a story yesterday about trying to use ordinary citizens as part-time fact checkers. So we can also use our data to figure out whether or not you can crowd check news in real time. And again, what we do here on the x-axis, we took, remember, we had 90 people who looked at each of these articles, so we started sampling crowds. We're like, we did sampled three-person crowds 10,000 times, and we sampled four, then five, then six. What we find is that with the crowds are also pretty good at getting right true news. Crowds are not very good at all at getting right false news. You can't just solve this necessarily with the fake news by going, with the false and misleading news by going to the crowds. Moreover, source still matters. Crowds are much better with mainstream news sources than they are with these junk and false news sources. And bipartisan crowds are not better. That was our first thought. We're going to do a lot more with that. In closing, I want to just take a moment in my closing here to talk a little bit to you about the importance of access to data. The study that I showed you here today, the false news study about over 65s who had shared more fake news on Facebook, the only reason that that study is in the public domain is because, A, our lab happened to have set up an experiment to do something else beforehand, a study to do something else beforehand. B, we happened to have the thought to do this. And C, we were able to collect the data that allowed us to do this. If we hadn't written that paper, we wouldn't be sitting here today talking about this fact that people online shared over 65 were more likely to share fake news. Regardless of the importance of that particular finding, the reality is Facebook had that data. Maybe Facebook chose never to run that study because they didn't want to know the answer. Maybe they knew the answer, but they chose not to share it in the public. But it's only in the public domain because we had access to that data. And the way we got access to that data was shut down by Facebook after the Cambridge Analytica scandal. We used an API that was open that's no longer available to open. And so we're living in an era right now where people are thinking, for very, very good reasons, about the importance of online privacy. But the issue with the thought about online privacy is that it has this normative bias, right, where we think privacy is good, right? So more privacy must be better. And it's this very powerful and well-meaning argument. But the reality of the situation is that we're living in is that the Facebook data, without even talking about combining it with things like Instagram or WhatsApp or Google, this is already the greatest data set that's ever been put together in sort of the history of human civilization for understanding human and social behavior. And the reality of the situation is, if motions towards greater and greater privacy are successful, that doesn't mean that this data set is not going to be analyzed. It doesn't mean that people aren't going to be learning things from the existence of this data. It means that the only people who are going to be analyzing it and learning things from this data set are going to be people who work for the platforms themselves. So this data can be used to learn things about teenage suicide. It can be used to learn about health. It can be used to learn about disaster response. And yes, it can be used to learn about the questions we raised at the beginning here, which is, what is the impact of social media on democracy? But if all this data gets pushed all the way back into the platforms through well-meaning and well-intentioned sort of efforts at preserving privacy, then this data set, which could be used to advance science in so many ways, which could be used to hold platforms accountable in so many ways, is in the short term going to be used to increase ad revenue for giant corporations. And in the long term, it's going to be used to do whatever those platforms decide they want to do with that data. I want to close my talk today with a plea that we really, really need to think about this privacy question, not as just, yes, privacy is good. We all agree privacy is good. We all want our data to be private. But as a trade-off between policies that ensure greater online privacy, but less access for outside analysts to do the kind of studies that we've showed you here today, and I'm sure you'll see more of, versus policies that you have to think about privacy but have these implications. Because we are living in a world, and you're going to get more and more of this over this weekend, where what's happening online is increasingly important for all aspects of life, where policymakers have to make decisions about what policy should be in this regard. And it's only through independent outside analysis of this data that we're going to know enough of what's happening to be able to make informed policy choices in the future. And so I'll close with that, and thank you very much for your time today, and look forward to answering questions.
Oh, Joshua Tucker.
I've been trying to cram everything into 30 minutes and I guess not doing a great job of it. I want to say all this work is done in a lab-based format. Everything you saw here today involved the work of lots and lots of people. All these projects involve lots of different people working on it. So all of their names are, the people who worked on these three particular papers are listed on here. But I just want to say, acknowledge them and say that this is work that needs to be done in labs by lots of people. So anyway,
fantastic.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
That was Joshua Tucker of New York University speaking at the 2020 Camden Conference here on Community Radio, WERU-FM at 89.9 and streaming online at weru.org. Professor Tucker's talk was entitled Social Media, Democracy, Fake News, and Fact-Checking. After his presentation, there was a Q&A session moderated by David Brancaccio. In addition to Professor Tucker, other speakers from the Saturday morning session of the conference were also on the panel, as was the conference's keynote speaker. Nick Newman is currently a visiting fellow at the Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism in London. He's the one with the British accent. Jeff Jarvis, a professor of journalism and innovation at the City University of New York, was the other morning panelist, the one who objected to the use of the term, quote, the mob, by the final panelist, Nico Meli, the conference's keynote speaker and a lecturer in public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School. Here is some of their conversation.
Tell us your name and your town, please.
I am Sally Smith, and I am used to be from Orono and Booth Bay, and now I'm from Vermont. I think you've issued a real challenge to this audience, me being over 65. And I am curious, because I have just discovered one of the apps that you can send a story that you like or don't like to and find out if it's fake. I think sharing those apps would be really useful for you guys to do to us.
So thanks very much. And again, I want to just to be very clear, you know, we're doing sort of basic scientific research on trying to understand what's happening here. 87% of people over age 65 in our sample did not share a fake news link. So it's not like everybody was doing this. It's just that it was the ratio of people who are over 65 to millennials in particular, I think, that was so eye-catching in that regard.
So in this room, maybe five people shared?
But I do want to say, in terms of interventions, to also offer a word of caution here, which is that we always want to think about the potential unintended consequences of our interventions, and we want to think about the potential to overreact to things that are bright and shiny and in front of us, and especially things that are bright and shiny that are troubling. So Jeff has talked a bit about content moderation. We do work in hate speech in that area. I'm happy to talk more about that if there's future questions. But just on this subject, of questions about news and news veracity. One of the things I didn't show you at all, because it's really still early research, but I wanted to share some of it with you, was how our professional fact checkers did in coming to agreement on whether a story was false or misleading or not. And the professional fact checkers agree a lot when it's a mainstream news story that's a true news story, but they don't agree all that much when it's coming off one of these junk sites. And even the professional fact checkers, we're getting lots of different answers on some of these questions, right? And again, going back to what I said during the talk about the power law, about all these things where the behaviors are intense in a small group of people, and then they're very, very minor in the vast majority of people, we have to think about the implications of our interventions. So say, for example, so the intervention you've said, it sounds harmless enough, and it seems like a very good idea, and it's something to get out there. But if what's happening now is we take a whole bunch of people who are maybe encountering one fake news story out of 4,000 they're going to see about the election, or two, or some small number, and we remind them whenever they see a news story, hey, this news story might actually not be true. You should click on this button to try to figure out when it's true. Maybe that's going to be great. There's some really interesting research out of MIT by David Rand and Gordon Pennycook, where they have looked at, you know, nudging people to think about things, and that people, when they pay more attention, they actually are better at figuring out whether stuff is fake or not. They call it kind of the laziness theory of false news. But maybe it's the case that actually, if we constantly remind people there might be false news out there, you have to be worried about false news, that for 90% of the population, this was not actually a big part of their life. It wasn't a big part of their news diet. It wasn't a big part of what they were consuming. But that 90% is getting this treatment, too, of being constantly reminded things could be false. And then when you have politicians that weaponize that and say that anything that makes them look bad or disagrees with their policies or tries to hold them accountable, that that's false. And this is sort of my biggest advice, because Jeff and I are at a lot of these things where people are from civil society groups, and there's always civil society groups that are pitching new types of devices like you're talking about here. Some of them may be good, but we don't know a priori, and these unintended consequences, when you're in a world of power laws, where you're targeting something at what is a narrow sliver of the population, but it's going to get aimed at the whole population, we want to, before we deploy these things, we want to know if we're confident they're doing what they're doing. And we can do research to do this. That's the really, really good news. But I think in terms of the panic and the stampede effect here, we want to be careful that we don't rush to solve problems before we understand the consequences of the types of interventions we're making. And we're working at some at the Center for Social Media and Politics, we're working, for example, right now on doing some analyses of some of you may have heard of NewsGuard, which like lights up a different color. We're trying to do studies right now and picture some of these things. So I think it's a good idea, but I just want to caution about head first jumping into these things without understanding the consequences.
Any further comments?
Add to that briefly. Yeah, I mean, I showed you earlier the levels of concern about whether you can tell the difference between what's true and fake. And, you know, in most, I think the average is 55%, in many countries, 70-80%. And in many of those countries, it has been where we've seen the media talking about this a lot. So when we ask people in focus groups, have you seen any of these things? You know, very few people do. The power law comes into play. But they've heard about it on social media, and they're worried about it. And, you know, there are legitimate concerns here, too. But I think the unintended consequences is an incredibly important thing to bear in mind.
All right. We have a question from a satellite location. Let's take a look. Does anyone check on the bias of fact checkers? Well, you started to answer. That's from Rockland. You might remind people about how you came up with these professional fact checkers.
Yeah, well, I mean, so let's go back to the question and ask for a second, why might we want to crowdsource fact checking, right? Why might the platforms, why are now we have Facebook and Twitter both talking about doing this? And the answer is, well, there's twofold answers, right? One answer is that we don't have enough professional fact checkers in the world. There are whole countries of the world. Like Facebook, we gotta remember, we get really focused on Facebook and what it's doing in the United States. But Facebook is in 190 different countries, right? And there are whole countries of the world that don't have professional fact checkers. And we could tell Facebook to go out and pay to train professional fact checkers there, which would be a great thing to do, but that's gonna take time. And so if we were to find that kind of crowdsourcing fact checking was an acceptable substitute for this, then that would allow us to employ fact checkers when we need them, right? It would give us more flexibility. But the other question, and this is the other reason is, when this question is getting at this, is that at least in the United States, fact checkers tend to be overwhelmingly of a liberal persuasion, right? And so if Facebook could go to a representative sample of its crowd or of Facebook users That would be a great way of addressing this particular question, this, oh, are the fact checkers potentially biased here? And so that's kind of, I think, why the platforms are interested in it, because it helps solve this problem. What we did in our study, which I mentioned briefly in the beginning there, is that we actually went out to 6 professional fact checkers for every one of these 150 articles. Now, we were this close to going out to only liberal fact checkers because we couldn't find a self-identified conservative fact checker. It's not a profession that seems to attract a lot of, but we found one. We found one at the end. And so actually in this study, it's 5, and again, it's self-identified. It's 5 self-identified liberals and 1 self-identified conservative fact checker. And I have some slides, and when we do this stuff about how the fact checkers, we are kind of curious to see like, okay, what if we just take the conservative fact checker? How does that, but our initial implications on that, on the professional fact checkers, seem to be not as bad as one might think it would be. I think the biases in the crowd seem much, much more serious at this point about the liberals not being able to identify liberal fake news, which admittedly is a small portion of the sample, so I don't want to overdo that, and the conservatives not being able to identify the conservative. But it's a legitimate problem and concern. It's a legitimate issue, and it's a serious policy issue for the platforms, because to the extent that you're in a country where the professional fact checkers are coming out of a particular political persuasion, it is always going to kind of call this into question. Which brings us back to a larger theme of this conference, which is the professionalization of journalism and the way in which the web has kind of undercut the professionalism of journalism. And we, you know, and other people, many other people who are going to speak the rest of this weekend can speak to this much better than I can. But journalism is a craft, right? It involves finding multiple sources. It involves collaborating. It involves these kinds of things. And so we'd like to think that the fact checkers, if that's their job and they are trained and have this skill set in how to fact check news articles for, and we got people who worked for newspapers and big newspapers and magazines to do fact checking, that they would have a skill set that would be more impervious to these political biases than when you ask average ordinary citizens to do it, which seems to be a big issue.
All right, a question from the Camden balcony. Tell us your name.
Hi, my name is Cassie Donald. I'm from Stockton Springs, Maine, here with the University of Maine at Farmington. My question is, given the element of subjectivity regarding truth, how do we go about determining what truth really is and filtering it throughout the media?
It's a variant of what we're talking about, but it's a problem for all of us, not the 6 fact checkers that you found.
I can answer that really quick, and then, then I'll pass it off to the panelists. I can answer it in terms of what we did for our study. Right, there's a huge problem here, because if we want to measure the ability of X group to successfully be fact checkers, so in this case, can we go to ordinary citizens, we need some ground truth that's correct. So for our study, we just said it's the modal response of the professional fact checkers, and we can't do any better than that, because my thought is, well, I could have my grad students double check what the fact checkers did, but then I'm like, why do my grad students know more than professional fact checkers about this? What we are gonna do though, and remember, the one thing about our study, it was designed, because every other study on fact-checking has dealt with stuff that's like months old, and there's already Snopes and PolitFact and all this stuff out there. We wanted to see, because we're interested in the policy implications here of whether you can actually improve the quality of the overall community of news that's available by making short interventions about whether you prioritize things or not in these algorithms. We were looking in the first 24 hours. So what we will ultimately do for ground truth in this study is we're going to go back to professional fact checkers 3 months later, and we'll be able to see, A, the consistency of how the professional fact checkers did in the first 24 hours. But that's the best thing we could come up with for ground truth, is pay the professional fact checkers, let a couple months go by on the stories, and then hopefully we have the total answer. But it's a very thorny question in this. It's a great question.
Nico?
I don't know. Some parts of it don't seem thorny to me at all. The Pope did not endorse Donald Trump.
Right.
You know, this is the warmest year of the decade, but every year has been the warmest year. The globe is warming. Like, there were some really non-negotiable facts out here. And so the idea that everything is kind of subjective, I completely reject.
So, and just to clarify, I was talking about having an an algorithmic rule that we could use in our lab for what's the correct answer to these questions. And I have a longer talk on this with slides, a lot of slides that have, some of the articles are tough. I mean, some of them are really kind of tough to take. But yes, I don't want to be saying there is objective truth and there's not objective truth. I was just talking about this was the best rule we could come up with, exactly because of what Nico's saying, that I think on these objective truth things, the modal answer from professional fact checkers is going to do a very good job.
I think the problem is that ordinary people just need a proxy for that. They need a simple way of sorting this out. They haven't got the time to do all this stuff, and which is why, you know, going back to the points we made earlier about the importance of brand and the importance of finding some shortcuts to what people can believe and what people can't believe.
Yes. If truth were easy, we wouldn't need thousands of journalists to get it. The problem is, I think that we have to go a little bit deeper into the psychological work that you're going to embark upon. Dana Boyd, a brilliant researcher in New York at Data and Society, look up her work, argues that we are in an epistemological war, where if I hate Josh, then I'm going to hate his facts, and it doesn't matter. Right? Kellyanne Conway, God help us, was right. There are alternate facts in this epistemological war. And so we've got to figure out how to grapple with that. We all know people who are disagreeing with what any sane person would think is rational, but something is happening in our brains, in neuroscience, that is making people go toward that thing. Why are we white people angry? We don't have any damn right to be angry. We've been terribly privileged. But there's some reason that old white men are being angry. Well, I'm not saying we have to empathize with that or coddle that, but if we have any hope of treating it, we might have to act more like psychologists and psychiatrists than journalists.
So I want to just offer maybe a different perspective of sorts, which is that when I think about the framers of the Constitution, they understood that there was like a natural tension between the monarch and the mob, right? That you didn't actually want either side to have too much power.
Oh, I hate that idea of the mob.
But
just
you
as
needed...
bad as the mass.
I for one don't want the decision of this country to be made by the mass. The whole idea of the republic and things like the U.S. Senate is to try and offer some buffer, right, between the mass and power.
But to presume that the world out there is a mass, that all these people here are all the same, is the going in wrong assumption. And what we don't have, now that we finally have systems to hear people as individuals, we have to learn how to do that. Right? Living While Black was a huge education to me as a white man in America, where not an education to anybody who's black to realize that the risk that they were under when they went shopping and went to lunch and went into their own homes. And only because the victims of this and the witnesses to it could now share that around the gatekeepers, around my colleagues in journalism and media, could I finally learn that. And so the systems are set up since Gutenberg, around this idea, or since 1814, of the mob and the mass. That's the idea we've got to get rid of. We've got to figure out democracy as the representation of lots of people and lots of voices.
And also, just since it was brought up, as the comparativist on this panel who's done research around the world, the Senate is one of the most disproportionate legislative bodies in the world.
Right.
Right? We are, and it's going to become an increasingly huge problem in U.S. politics because, I mean, we are in a situation where in California there are two senators for 38 million people and there's two senators for 300,000 people in Wyoming. And as we head towards a situation, as politics has gotten sorted in this country more geographically than it was previously, and you don't have Democrats who are winning Senate seats in the Dakotas anymore and some of these situations, the numbers I'm seeing is that we're headed within not too many years to situations where 50% of the Senate will represent 30% of the population of the United States. And so I think this is just a warning flag.
But that's just a process problem in a sense. You could solve that by changing some of the rules about allocation in the Senate. My point is that the Senate and other parts of the government, like Supreme Court, were set up to basically provide a firewall between, I'm sorry, Jeff, the mob who maybe think global warming isn't real and nothing we can say will convince them otherwise, the mob who maybe think Russians are not interfering in our elections and nothing we can say will convince them otherwise. Like, I'm not sure that, like, in this, the epistemological war is a long one. That's not actually new. That's history. And what I think of as the ideas in like the Federalist Papers and the ideas that were grappled with in the founding of this country was trying to figure out some way to navigate that war that would lead to really good public policy.
We've just heard some of the question and answer session that followed Joshua Tucker's presentation at the 2020 Camden Conference, whose theme was The Media Revolution, Changing the World. Joining Professor Tucker on the Q&A panel were David Brancaccio, the conference moderator, Professor Jeff Jarvis of the City University of New York, Nick Newman of the Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism, and the conference's keynote speaker, Nick O'Malley of the Harvard Kennedy School. Our third program from the 2020 Camden Conference will air at 4 p.m. on Tuesday, March 31st. If you missed part of this program or would like to hear it again, or if you missed the first program in the series, they will be available online in the Public Affairs Archive at weru.org. I'm Jim Campbell. Thanks for listening.